You're listening to the Hazard Ground Podcast, with service members from across the military sharing their stories of combat and survival. And now, here's your host, Mark Zeno.
Welcome into the Hazard Ground Podcast. As always, we appreciate you joining us each and every week. Before we get started with this week's episode, a story of a Green Beret who turned his military career into a $100 million business. More on that coming up. But first, our usual reminders. Make sure you guys give us a follow on all the social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But most importantly, make sure you guys hit the Apple Podcast reviews again, please. We are growing, but we need to get more. And the reviews do not have to be something long and substantial. For example, Cass576 wrote, "Love this podcast. Deeper questions and more thoughtful than the rest, period." And that's the end of it. Like, that's the whole entire review. Yes, there are some other longer reviews, like 11ACR Folda says, "The Hazard Ground podcasts are very inspiring and great to listen to on long trips. Some of the podcasts I had listened to before, I listened to again. Each time I discover something new or something I had initially missed. I recently drove to Maine and back from Georgia. The Hazard Ground makes those long trips bearable. I highly recommend everyone subscribe to the Hazard Ground podcast." Thank you guys both for the comments, both short and long. But seriously, whatever the review is, it's going to help us out. So please go to Apple Podcasts. You could do it right there on your iPhone and click on the Hazard Ground Podcast at the bottom. There's a rating and a review. Just hit the rating button. Give us 5 stars. Type a short review and you're on your way. So certainly please, again, hit the Apple Podcast reviews for us. Help us continue to grow. Don't forget also to subscribe to our YouTube channel. Follow us there. And of course, our Amazon promotion on our website, hazardground.com. As always, you go to the bottom of the homepage or click on the sponsors tab. Hit that Amazon button and you'll be directed right to Amazon. You can do all of your normal Amazon shopping and we'll get a percentage of what you guys spend and we'll donate a percentage of that back to some of the great charities that you've heard featured here on the Hazard Ground. So wishing everybody a wonderful, happy, and healthy week, and on to this week's episode. Joining us on the Hazard Ground this week is a former Army Staff Sergeant who spent 5 years as a Green Beret. He has multiple deployments around the world, including a tour in Iraq as well. He founded the company called GoRuck, which is a company whose mission statement is simple: inspire, challenge, and equip people to ruck up with friends and embrace the suck. He wrote a book about his experiences in building GoRuck titled How Not to Start a Backpack Company. He graduated from Georgetown Business School. He is also on the board of directors of the Green Beret Foundation. He is Jason McCarthy joining us here on the Hazard Ground. Jason, welcome, brother. Great to have you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, look, this is a great story. One we've chased after for a while here on the Hazard Ground. GoRuck, one of the more popular veteran-owned companies. Everybody seems to know who you guys are. You've built a little bit of a mini empire to your credit, so certainly interested to hear about all of that. But you're one of those folks who signed up right after 9/11, correct?
After 9/11, because of 9/11, absolutely.
What was the sort of background behind that decision? Where were you, and sort of what do you remember?
Well, I had just graduated from college in May of 2001, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do something that mattered, but I really didn't know what that meant. You know, I didn't grow up around the military. My grandfather was in Korea, but we never talked about it. You know, that generation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just something where I wanted to do something great, but it's a really humbling and kind of scary and awkward and all sorts of different feelings about that time from when you're about 15 until, 25, 30 sometimes. You're just trying to figure out, what's my way in the world? And, I don't think back and say, man, 9/11 was awesome, because it was a horrific, horrible day, right? A little piece of everyone died that day. Mm-hmm. And yet, for me, it provided absolute moral and clarity in just so many ways. And so it made it really clear to me that I needed to serve my country. And so I applied all around and went through that game. And ultimately, I enlisted into the 18 X-ray program to try to become a Green Beret. So that was in the fall of 2003.
What did your dad say when you told him you were going to enlist?
My dad was not the issue. My mom was the issue.
Okay.
So my mom cried at the kitchen counter and said no, 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 and all that stuff. Right. I mean, I think that it's a normal, natural thing that in a time of war, when your son comes to you and says he wants to go fight the war, that a mom just assumes that you're going to die, right? And at some point, I think for those of us who were there, we all kind of made our peace in our own way, you know? Like, you just assume it's going to happen. And, you know, IEDs were the big threat. And you just kind of make your peace with it. Like, this, and then you're liberated, and then you can go do your job, right? But I wasn't there yet. I was at the point where my mom was crying on the kitchen, you know, and then it was like, they're trying to talk me out of it. I'm like, well, no, I already signed the paper. Like, we're moving forward with this. And, you know, ultimately everybody really supported me, and everyone really got behind it. And it was, you know, my family's way of kind of supporting our country at that time in a really overt way.
What did you know about Green Berets at that point that made you go for that option immediately?
Well, it took me a little bit of time. I mean, I actually applied to the CIA for a long while. And, you know, that's a really lengthy process. And I kept asking them about their paramilitary side. And eventually this guy in a, like, Northern Virginia hotel conference room took me aside and was like, hey, we didn't really hire directly to join the paramilitary side. You got to go join special forces or special operations. And I was like, man, I wish someone would have told me that a year ago, you know? And that just was what it was. So then I'm like, all right, well, I guess I got to go join special forces. So then I went through other, what special forces, and you can overthink this stuff, especially when you're a college boy like I was, you know, you can overthink this stuff until the end of time. And the wars started passing me by. And so at some point I'm like, look, I got to make a decision here. I apply to be an officer, and everyone has this notion that, you know, go to war, go to jail, and the military gets the bottom of the barrel and all this stuff, which I found to be completely untrue. I found a waiting list to get into the military a mile long. And, you know, for whatever reason, I wasn't getting in as an officer. And this is now October of 2003. So the invasion into Baghdad's already complete. And just like Afghanistan, Iraq, it just felt like the wars were passing me by. And it felt like this really stinking feeling in the gut of my stomach. And you know, I knew that I would regret it for the rest of my life if I didn't sign that line and say, hey, send me.
Yeah, the wars are passing you by. Little did we know, right? 20 years later, we're still in Afghanistan. I just chuckle when I hear that.
True story.
Well, because we all thought that back then, right? Like, everybody who signed up to go to war, like, hey, I want to fight for my country. You know, they attacked us. I want to fight. We better hurry up and go because, you know, we're going to miss this whole thing. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, I will say there was, for special forces, you're right. I mean, I it's a long time to be in these places, but as far as basically at that time, everybody in special forces was fighting the war.
Yes.
And now it is certainly a lot more restrictive. I mean, you've got guys that become Green Berets. They're not going straight to war. They're doing other stuff, or they're doing, you know, and I'm sure it's the same across a lot of other branches. And, you know, I mean, I'm not here. I'm not some warmonger. You know, it's funny when you go there and you do that, it pushes you the opposite. Right. It's like, I got to prove stuff to myself and the people around me. And I want to be a good dad, and I want to be a good husband and stuff like that. But I don't need to beat my chest at all. Like, you just, you gain humility, and I gained a lot of humility. And, you know, I'm glad that I got to go and do that though. Right. It would have been an incomplete experience had I not deployed to war.
Yes, I concur. Pause on these sort of chronological events here. Just, you're curious your thoughts, and you talk about Green Berets right now who, you know, it's a completely different skill set, right? And prior to the War on Terror, we knew Green Berets existed, but they did not have the public persona that they do now. And you've been out for over a decade now, but just kind of your thoughts on the way Green Berets Special Operations is profiled now, how it's such a common understanding by the average citizen, and the way Green Berets have had to transform what they do into more commonplace missions, if you will. I mean, does it bother you at all? I mean, do you have any sort of feelings on, you know, what being a Green Beret has become these days?
I mean, first off, it's one of the great honors of my life to associate with the regiment. I mean, it really changes you as a person because you see and you feel what right looks like. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that nobody in my generation was a self-made man. No team was a self-made team, right? We stood on the shoulders of those who came before us, and it really is a generational thing. So the last really significant and sustained fighting was in Vietnam by the Green Berets, specifically 5th Special Forces Group. And that led to, back up to that, which was the classic mission there was working by, with, and through indigenous forces inside of Vietnam, right?
Foreign internal defense, as they call it.
So against the Viet Cong, the North Vietnamese, all these things, right? And so that mission set became exceptionally valuable immediately after 9/11 because the Green Berets are a nimble force. And we're treated as force multipliers, right? So we move into a war zone and we train up indigenous fighters and we fight by, with, and through them. So when the weather was terrible in Afghanistan in the fall of 2001 and they said, hey, we can't have anybody here until spring, you know, POTUS and Bush and Rumsfeld basically kicked it back and said, no, we need boots on the ground now. And so the Green Berets got sent in, and the classic mission of the Green Berets came to fruition, right? Which is work by, with, and through the Northern Alliance in this case. And then you do that to defeat the Taliban. And for some historical perspective, this was done in the boneyard of the Soviet Empire, right? Afghanistan was not a place where they were strangers to fighting or anything like that. Like they crippled and they toppled the Soviet Empire. And in about 2 months, by working with these local forces and with the Air Force, right? I mean, the United States Air Force was, and will always be an extraordinary asset on the battlefield. I mean, God bless those guys and gals. And so you had this proof of concept right out of the gates. Like, look what the Green Berets did with the help of the CIA, by the way. But look what happened here. It's like, okay, Special Forces did it. Well, it becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know? You just keep going to your – it's like you keep giving the ball to the guy that's going to score. And, you know, some of that stuff – Green Berets have become kind of a catch-all solution, and as well as Special Operations, right? I mean, because we're cut from the same cloth as the other Special Operations services, but – I think that as the wars have wound down, the dependency on Special Forces has stayed exceptionally high, and it's probably not sustainable. You know, I mean, it's not a magic pill. It's not a silver bullet. You can't just send Green Berets into every situation or our counterparts in other special operations, and it's just going to get fixed immediately. Or it's just kind of not how it works, you know?
Right.
So this is, it's one of those situations where, look, if you do some good and you get some praise and they give you more work, that's a good thing. Nobody signed up for less work. So I'm not here to sit and say, don't give us the missions. I'm just here to say it's time to take a step back and look at what the role is. And fundamentally, I mean, my take, and this is probably just because this is how I was professionally brought up, is that a lower signature, more highly trained team is better than just throwing soldiers and assaulters at a problem, right? Like fewer is better, especially in the medium and in the long run, because we're not out there to seize land. We don't want to take over countries. We need to have other broader objectives, and Special Forces needs to be at the tip of the spear of that. But it's not like we don't want to occupy these places. That's not what we're built for. And so it's one of those, look, we could talk about this until the end of time and go back and forth. But ultimately, I'm really proud that I served in Special Forces. I'm really proud of the guys that taught me and trained me. I'm really proud of the guys I served with. And I'm increasingly and exceptionally proud of those who are out there doing God's work for our country now.
Amen. All right. When you signed up to be a Green Beret, what did you know about it? And I mean, I know you talked about the paramilitary side, but specifically the process, because you got to go to assessment and selection and all the other stuff. And so were you prepared for that? Did you read up on it? Did you study it? Or did you kind of just go into it blind?
I mean, I came in essentially blind. If you would ask me what's the difference between Green Berets and Rangers and Delta and, you know, Recon, I mean, it's just, there's so much that's really hard to understand. You know, I knew I wanted to be infantry and I wanted to be more infantry, right? And so, you know, I didn't really understand things. I'll give you a good example. I had no idea what rucking was before I got to sort of towards the end of basic training. They said, hey, here's all this stuff and here's a rucksack. Put it in there. Follow me. Right. Keep up. You know, you're at 4:30 at Fort Benning. Everyone's in formation. And it's like, it's just a, you know, it's a slinky. It's just up and down the whatever, the hardball there. And, you know, I didn't know what this was. And so then come to find out that rucking is literally all you're going to do in special forces training. I mean, you see the stuff you watch. So you watch Discovery Channel, right? And you're like, oh, it's log PT. It's a rifle PT and there's lots of yelling. Like, not the case at all. that's 0% the case. There's some bullhorns for, I'm going to say, 1 or 2 days of your entire Q course, there's bullhorns in it. Like, it's just not that kind of a course. I mean, yeah, if you've got 150 dudes out there, you've got to yell to be heard, but not because you're angry or screaming at people, right? It's just like, you know, but the cameras on Discovery, they, you know, you got one day a log PT and it's built for cameras. And so, you know, that's what they cover. I get it. So I was blind, man. I didn't know. And then I was just kind of, hey, deal with it and adapt or die. And I just had this horrific, horrific fear of failure, right? Like, I do not want to sign up to do this and then end up not doing this job, right? Like, I do not want to fail this. And that became my supreme motivation.
Toughest part of assessment and selection for you?
Well, phase two was really tough. So phase two was like our version of Ranger School. It's called SUT, Small Unit Tactics. All the state numbers change and stuff all the time, but it's just really slow patrolling. I mean, it's based on Vietnam era tactics. So ambushes and I'm kind of built for more speed. Like, I enjoyed special forces assessment selection. Hey, here's your rucksack. Go find your point. I'm 41, almost 42 now. And I would go back to SFAS, the Special Forces Assessment and Selection. I would go back now if I could, right? It's 3 weeks. I kind of know what it is. Land nav, you're out there under the stars. I mean, maybe I wouldn't want to go in January, but I would. Like, it's not that bad. Right. It's all mental. And once you know how to do it, you're good. Phase two, I would not go back to that. That would not be fun. It just, there was just something about it. And you had a lot of the guys in there who had been in the infantry and now we're coming through special forces. And they had a bunch of us with no experience whatsoever, straight off the street. And I just felt overwhelmed to a certain extent, I'm not like biting my fingernails off all day, every day or anything. It just was, I just kind of didn't get it. And it was just hard for me. And so the tactics and you're just drinking out of a fire hose.
When you look back at the, you know, teamwork aspect of this whole thing and learning it, because it's such a critical part of becoming a Green Beret, right? It's, you talk about, you know, not wanting to fail. You can fail tasks, but still succeed as a team player and in teamwork fashion. And you have to go back and do it again and pass, obviously, to go through the course. But were you surprised at how team-oriented things were?
I expected and wanted to be part of something bigger than myself. So that element of teamwork and all that, I mean, I was not surprised, but you just don't know what it's going to be like until you actually go through it. You know, I mean, you're just cold and you're wet and you're tired and you've been out there for weeks. And it's just, you will eventually, people find out who you are. You can't hide it. And so it's one thing to be on a team for a 45-minute workout and you got fist bumps and rah, rah, and I'll buy you 100 beers when we're done. And that's great, right? I mean, and I do that stuff and it's great. It's awesome, right? This is America. You know, we need to do that stuff. But what we don't do is go out for a week or 2 weeks and you're starving and you don't sleep. And it's just, you have any rational person is just miserable, right? So you have to be irrational. And that's kind of how it works. And, you know, you find out who can endure that kind of stuff and still be a positive influence on the team. Because if you let your head go and you just go to a negative place, it's a cancer. And that's basically one of the things that they're testing or seeing how you do, is because there's no substitute for the stress, right? I mean, there's a couple crutches or things that you just can't deal with. There's cold, food or lack thereof, and sleep. Those are kind of the big three. And for me, it was always the cold. I didn't care about sleep and I didn't care about food, but man, the cold, like it's out there and you're just sitting in there in that ambush line and you're just jackhammer shivering because you've been there for hours. You know, it's the rucksack heavy, you set it down, you lay into your ambush line and you just sit there and it's just so cold. It's down to my very existence. And it's like, you have to just deal with it. And that's the thing, right? Nobody cares. If you decide to say, hey, I can't take this because I'm too cold, nobody cares. Like that, it's just, then don't be here. Just quit then. Yeah. Hey, and it's not, they're not rude about it. It's just part of the deal. It's like, you don't get that anywhere else. I mean, where else? Everyone's coddling everything all the time now. Mm-hmm. Right. And which to some extent it's okay. Like the customer's always right type stuff. I believe in that stuff. Right. But I also believe in personal responsibility. And I believe that you need to get out and you need to think about something more than yourself. And you need to be part of your neighborhood. You need to be part of your community. You need to put something above just yourself. That's the foundation, the fabric of America. And so out there, it's all about that. Like nobody cares. Like, oh, you've got, you know, well, I'll give you an example. Let's say you got a little bit of food left and it's just you and your buddy and you're out there on the line. And it's like, maybe he already ate his whole everything. He doesn't have anything left and whatever. And you pull yours out and you're like, oh, hey, I'm just going to eat this because you already ate yours. Like, that's a good way to get hated, you know? and so it's one of those things where you've got to be a team player and you've got to do this just as a way of life. And once you learn those lessons, you're a much better and happier person.
Right. You mentioned before that you're going to get found out. Like people are going to find out who you are. And depravity sort of in general in life exposes, I don't want to say the ugliness of people, but it just sort of gets you down to bare essentials of what's important to you. And I'm curious, as you're going through this, are you aware of that? I mean, Evergreen Berea you talk to talks in hindsight about it, of, you know, knowing that, hey, you know, there's a guy that went through your course, the Q course or SFAS with you, that inevitably showed their ass, so to speak, and you knew from the jump that this person wasn't going to make it. Were you one of those people who was aware of that while it was going on? Like, hey, I can't let myself go to a place where, I'm going to sort of be the worst version of myself in front of others?
Yeah, I know what you're trying to say. It's hard to put my finger on exactly, but I know exactly what you're... There are certain people that this line of work, they're just not cut out for.
Right.
And you can, I mean, you get to the point where, and now after having been through it and having served a group and through some of the other stuff that I've done, just team building stuff through GoRuck, I will almost tell you, I'm really close to being able to just look someone in the eye for a very short period of time and telling you if they have that gene. I'm not every gene, not the, hey, you know, they're going to, you know, call mom on Valentine's Day or call their wife on Valentine's Day or send their mom flowers on their birthday. But like the gene of they could pass something like this, you can smell it. You can see it in someone's eye if you know what you're looking for, how to look. And so for me, I mean, no, the thing is, like, I lived in fear. I lived in fear constantly of not meeting the standard. And you don't know what the standard is. Standard is winning, right? Do your best at all times. Just do your best. Do what you think is right. Well, nobody's going to tell you. Nobody's going to tell you what's right. You've got to do what you think is right. That's the point. And so it's one of those things where it's really stressful. And I never reached a point where, hey, I almost quit. I never reached a point where it was like, oh, I've had it enough. There were really, really stressful times. And I probably lost some years off of life because of them. But I never reached that point where I said, okay, I'm done, right? And then I was saved by something miraculous. It just never happened. And a lot of people, you can watch it, right? I mean, you can see it becomes a pressure cooker because you have peers. You have peer evaluations throughout. And the cadre uses those against you. So if you start to be the last in the class, the cadre says, hey, there's 13 people on the squadron and you're 12 or you're 13, you're probably not going to make it, right? Mm-hmm. You can leave it at that. And it's just a pressure cooker then, because you start to sit and say, how do I get better? Right? How do I do better? And so, you know, then you have to draw on things like, hey, can I carry more weight? Can I get up earlier? There's no room for there's no margin of error. You have to just be on top of your stuff, and you have to. Man, it's probably coming off as lame. It's just a pressure cooker. And when you get there, and I just lived in fear. And some phases I did really well, and in other phases I struggled. I struggled at phase two. You know, phase one, basically pretty straightforward. Like, even phase four, Robin Sage had a blast. I mean, it's a mock war, an unconventional warfare situation all over the state of North Carolina. Like, you're doing raids on downtown little North Carolina towns, you're sleeping in barns, you're linking up with the underground and all this stuff. Like, it was a blast. Other parts of the training, though, were miserable. And, you know, what it really came down to for me was the reason why I made it through was because I was physically capable and mentally I wouldn't quit. And, you know, I trained up really, really hard before I joined the Army. And I stayed on top of my fitness throughout my time in the Q course. And ultimately, that will earn you a lot of respect. If you can, bottom line, if you can carry more weight, greater distances than the people that you're around, and you can do this on day 21 or day 25, and it really sucks, then you're probably going to be just fine. And that's kind of what, set me apart in some of my darker moments in the Q course.
So you graduate from the Q course, and all said and total, this is about, you know, 2.5-3 years worth of training that you had to get to get, you know, to wear the Green Beret when it's all said and done. And, you know, earlier you worried about the war passing you by. Were you worried in the 3 years of training that the war might pass you by?
I mean, I was worried, right? I mean, this is the sort of Pat Tillman story that he joined the Rangers instead of the Green Berets because he wanted to get to war sooner. And God bless him, right? America needs more people like Pat Tillman.
Amen.
So the short answer is Iraq started to get really shitty at that time.
Yeah.
You know, so
I was there.
So, you know, so the surge was what?
07.
It was right when... Yeah, it was
07,
right
08, yeah, yeah.
So there was a build-up to maybe the surge, but like 06 was horrible.
Yeah, 05 you know? And 06 was the height of the violence in that country.
And so the wars started, you know, 03, when you're doing victory laps and Saddam's statue's coming down. Mm-hmm. And it's like, man, America's invincible and, you know, mission accomplished and all this stuff. It's like, oh, I'm missing everything. And Afghanistan was kind of an afterthought. And, you know, and then it started to get really bad again. And I, you know, it kind of brings back some just the unease that I felt at the time, because I'm like, man, this is such a shit show. And like, you're at the mercy of the army. That's what I signed up for. I signed up to go where America needed me to go. And, you know, there's also some humility that you find in that, because, you know, Johnny needing every special thing for him, and, you know, he's going to get whatever he wants whenever he wants it, and all this stuff. Like, that's not how the military works. You are an asset that will be used by the Secretary of Defense and President of the United States of America. And you sign up for that, that's what you do. And it's worth it. No matter what, it's worth it. And yet, anyway, the wars started to not be passing us by, because Iraq is bad and it's just only getting worse. And it was a bad form of bad. Not like, oh, we've got clear mission and purpose and we're going to go over and do this great thing like Operation Overlord or something. It just started to get really messy. And IEDs were the big thing. And there's just something like the fear of IEDs was not a fun fear. Ooh. Again, these are the things you have to wrestle with. You just have to overcome.
Yeah.
So, you know, by the time I got to 10th group I got to Fort Carson in Colorado in 06. And it's like, hey, we're leaving for Iraq. So that's the deal. And that's what we did.
You didn't have any choice in 10th group, right? That was predetermined for you?
Well, I had passed out of the German language. So I didn't go to language school, because I passed out. I'd studied a lot of German prior. And the way the groups work, if you have certain languages, you go to certain groups,
right?
Because when it's not all about Iraq and Afghanistan, it's a big world and you have sort of areas that you're responsible for. And so 10th group's origins were, you know, 10th group was the first group founded June 19th, 1952. There's a plug for the originals. And the reason why it was called 10th Special Forces Group was because it was deception. Wanted the Russians to believe, as we were fighting the you know, early stages of the Cold War, to believe that there were more groups than just one. And so, you know, that became the battle space was Eastern Bloc, Europe, and all of Europe. And so, anyway, long story short is German is a language that will get you assigned to 10th group.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's just kind of how it went.
Well, and for those civilians listening, each Special Forces group is assigned to a region of the world. And as Jason just mentioned, you know, learning a foreign language is part of being a Green Beret. And whether you're 5th group in, you know, Asia, or you are... What, 7th in South America, right? Or is that 3rd? I get confused.
7th South America.
Right, 7th South America.
If you're Hispanic in America, like you speak, you know, Spanish.
You're going to 3rd.
Like you're going 7th.
7th group, I mean, yeah. So that was just for the civilians listening, who just give them a little more background on that. All right, so you get to Iraq in 2007. What is your mission? Where are you going? What are you doing? I mean, what do you know at this point in time as you head into deployment?
I mean, realize I'm the lowest of the low guy on the totem pole. So, you know, it's like, all right, we're going. Right, was kind of it. But we went to Basra first, and it was a difficult time there for everyone. But the Brits were pulling out. So that was the first thing in Basra. And it was just, you know, it was just not, it felt like a very defensive posture. And if you're out there and you haven't experienced this kind of things, it's counterintuitive, but in matters of violence, offense is actually safer.
Yes.
Right. If you take the fight to the enemy, you get to pick the time, the place, the location, you get to do those things. You can fall back on your training. That's what teams do. That's why you train. Kinetic operations are like, that's like, you're good at those. It's when everything is kind of, you're on your back heels, it gets really dangerous, because you also, the hairs on the back of your neck, they're standing up all the time. Anyway, you know, it was every afternoon rocket lobbing time onto our base. And, you know, it was just the security posture was really low. The IEDs were coming over from Iran in massive ways. You know, Prince Harry was actually supposed to get stationed down to Basra right toward the end of our deployment. But the one of the British officers who had his billet was killed in an IED blast in an ESP rather, I believe, an ESP blast in the sector. I mean, it was just like not a fun time to be there. And I don't mean from the standpoint of morale was low. It wasn't low. Morale was good. I mean, like our teams, this is why you train and you love the people around you. I just mean the whole operational environment was kind of weird. And so anyway, yeah, so that was where we started. And then I got pushed out to a different location, and I served in Nasiriyah, which was kind of just up the road, so to say. Mm-hmm. And so I was there for the remainder of the deployment in 07.
It's interesting you talk about, you know, offense being the, you know, the force multiplier, if you will, or, you know, being on the offensive. And for civilians, again, listening, I'd use this analogy. If you're going to be in a car accident, you'd rather be the one going faster doing the hitting than the car standing still. Right, the advantage is on your side in that case, as far as safety is concerned. So, with that in mind, do you get to do offensive operations when you move to Nasiriyah?
So the challenge was that it was called a PIC, a provincial Iraqi council province, a PIC province, and what that meant was if I messed that up, I got it pretty close, right? but basically, what that meant was that they had overall operational control over everything in the sector. And so when we first showed up, they were not super interested in having us there, right? I mean, said, hey, you know, do you have weapons? Hey, do you have, what can you give us? Like, give us things, you know, kind of like the rest of the universe. And you know, we're like, oh, we're going to train you and do all this. So we had the police force there, and it was not until, I mean, Muqtada al-Sadr decided to send down a bunch of troops down to the city, and they were overrun and needed our help. And so then that's when we became really good friends with them. And, you know, they called us in to come rescue them out of the hotel and to rescue us out of the hotel. And, you know, it was just like chaos in the streets and yeah, that was my introduction, so to say.
Until that point, was there a moment where you thought, you know, I signed up in a post 9/11 world to go and fight for my country, and I haven't done anything that I thought I was signing up to do? Like, was there a void to that, or do you just kind of get wrapped up in, I don't want to phrase it like Green Beret lifestyle, but, you know, just be the idea of being a Green Beret sort of
measure. There's a massive void. It's like everybody knows, be careful what you wish for, mm-hmm. right? It's like you don't want anything bad to happen, but you want something to test you to happen. Yeah. You want something, you want to prove your training, you want to prove what you've been through in some which way. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, a very basic thing is like, did you get a CIB, yes or no, right? I mean, which basically means, were you in a firefight? Did you get shot at, yes or no? Did you return fire, yes or no? And, you know, that was the night I got my CIB. And it was you know, we were fortunate. We had our partner force and we had the Air Force. I mean, I was in charge of controlling the aircraft, so, because I'd been to that school. And I mean, they sent us everything. I mean, everything. So we had the biggest gunship in country above us the whole duration of that mission. And then we had all sorts of fast movers, so F-16s and others. I mean, it's called a stack, right? So if you have a lot of aircraft showing up, you have to mine the stack. meaning which aircraft is at which height and what are you having them do? So, you know, I'm having all the fast movers do aerial reconnaissance and shows of force, you know, all over town. And and then, you know, we're out. It sort of, it went from defense to offense. And so the defense was go recover the bodies at the hospital. The offense was, where are the bad guys? And that was a switch that happened that night. And so, you know, because the intelligence basically said, hey, there's a lot of guys coming down here. And back to that maxim of in matters of violence, offense is safer. If you don't fight them now while they're transitioning, then they're just going to dig in and they're going to get stronger. And so you want to deal with it offensively. It's kind of like the definition of courage is not being afraid. It's saddling up anyway. And mm-hmm. so that was our task that night. We worked with our partner force. We basically did loops of the town looking for a gunfight. Everywhere we went, we were looking to pick a fight. And I can remember back in the day when I heard something like that before I had done that, and I thought it sounded crazy. Why would you do that? It doesn't make any sense, you know?
It's like William Wallace in Braveheart when he's like, I'm going to go pick a fight, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's exactly right. And it's like, why would you do that when you could hope for peace or something? And unfortunately, that's just not how the world works sometimes. And the situation that we found ourselves in, it was safer and better for security and better in every which way if we took it to the enemy. So that's what we did.
After that's over, and again, I know you're not focused on, you know, the medal and the CIB or, you know, on your chest or anything like that, but do you get a sense of, this is what I came here to do. I tested my medal. I passed. I've sort of fulfilled, for lack of a better term, my own like little personal destiny that I started out. Is there any sense of that feeling?
Well, the medal, I mean, like the CIB is like whatever. I mean, right. I just say that like a thing that's official. The only thing that really mattered was the respect of the people I was around. And after that night, they gave me my team shirt when we got back from that mission.
That's
right,
because awesome.
Up until then I was the new guy, and like that team shirt, I mean, at a really deep level, it means more to me than my Special Forces tab or my Green Beret, like the actual physical things, you know, like my knife or whatever, right? Like the symbol of that team shirt means more to me than anything else that I did in my time in Special Forces, because it's one thing to earn something in training, but it's another thing to earn it in war. And
right.
It's one thing to earn it, you know, a certain way. And it's another thing when you don't know exactly how to earn it, but then they tell you that you've earned it and that you earned it in war. And so that meant a lot to me.
Yeah, you're part of the crew now.
And it always will.
Yeah, you're part of the crew now.
Yeah, and from that point on, it was like I was absolutely part of the team. I mean, there was no – it happened fast, you know. There was no division. It was just – I mean, look, I'm still the low guy. It's not like I've got all this wealth of experience and everyone wants me to pontificate my opinions on every mission or anything. That's not the point, right? You got to know your place in life. And my place was still to listen, but they knew that they could count on me. And that gave me a lot of confidence. I mean, more than anything from my time in the military, their confidence, their trust, I should say, trust in me is what it's like an eternal spring of confidence. And
yeah.
You have to fill it up other ways. But it really meant a lot, and it's something that you can't. It's not for sale, and you can't experience that feeling. If you can't experience that feeling unless you earn it, and it will require risk. There's risk to your mortal existence to earn it.
Yeah,
and that's what a lot of people don't. they're uncomfortable doing that. And so they choose a different path, and, you know, they make peace with that path one way or another.
I was fortunate enough to have a similar experience in that, you know, again, I'm not a TAP guy, but I was fortunate enough to deploy into that realm. And I've told this story several times, but, you know, the only way that I realized that I was, you know, recognized by Green Berets as a piece of the team that was valuable is because they kept giving me more work. They trusted me enough to continue to give me more work and give me assignments and ask me to do things and ask me to help them out because they knew I could get the job done. And that is something I've taken with me my entire career, as far as, you know, understanding your role. As you talk about, everybody's got to know their role. I wasn't there to assault on objectives. I was there to be a support function for these guys, but every time they needed something, they came to me. And that was the one way I knew that I was sort of accepted, as a peer, you know, a military peer in their eyes, was that they trusted me enough to keep coming back. Because I learned very quickly that, no one was going to tell me that I wasn't useful. They weren't going to tell me that I wasn't doing wrong. No one was going to stop and hold my hand and go, you know, we really like you to do a little bit more. They just find a different solution if you're in the way. And so the way I realized and recognized that I was doing good was that they kept coming back. And that was, as you said, you can't put a price on that. That's something that I earned and I take with me everywhere.
That is 100% how it works, right? I mean, to this day, it's kind of like, it's the same in athletic sport teams, but it's really like this in the team room. If someone ignores you, that's the worst, right? If they're messing with you all the time, right? I mean, that's our love language. Like, you're kind of young, and you just love being on the team. Everyone loves being on the team. And so you don't know how to express this. Even when you're older, a little bit older, like, kind of can't express things certain ways. So what do? You just mess with each other, you know, mm-hmm. all the time. Like practical jokes, you know, everything is on limits. Everything. And, you know, if someone messes up, you just like rake them over the coals. But if someone is distanced from the team for whatever reason, the first telltale sign is silence.
It's a kiss of death.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like nobody wants to talk to that person. And man, before too long, that person is off the team. It's just kind of how it works. So if they're feeding you work, if it's like, hey, do this, I need you, you need me, that's how it works, right? Like you literally, in order to survive, you need each other. This is such a foreign concept in so many ways in our modern day society, but it feels great. You just have to choose your team wisely.
And the biggest motivation is not letting anybody down. Like they came to me and asked me to do something. I just didn't want to let them down. I didn't want them to think that I couldn't do anything that they needed to ask me to do. And that was enough motivation every day to try to get up and kick as much ass as possible. Because I didn't want them to ever look at me and go, I'll find a different solution. You know, I wanted to be the solution every time.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it works, man, you know? Like it works way better than money or ribbons or anything like that, right? Like the team can handle the team's business, and the team is really good at doing that.
All right, so that deployment ends, and you end up going where next?
You know, classic stuff, went back to Carson for a bit, and then we did a backfill SIF mission. So Commanders in Extremist Force, I think it changed names, but everything changes names. So was located, first of the 10th was located in Stuttgart, Germany. And so we went there so that they could go to Iraq because they hadn't been yet. And then while we were there, we trained up, we did some training there and stuff. And then we also did a JSET. I don't even know what that stands for. You basically go to, you know, joint combined something. I don't know. But we went to Mauritania, which is in Western Africa, and trained up their troops there. And that was one of the greatest 5 or 6 weeks of my life. That was awesome. It was just my team and me in the Islamic Republic of Mauritania. And, you know, we trained up their troops for probably 20 hours a week because that was the maximum that they wanted. And the rest of the time was ours. So we went to the range and, you know, we explored the country on the weekends a little bit and, you know, worked out. And we took over a little mini hotel. I mean, it's out in the middle of nowhere, right? Like, I don't know, 3-something-hour drive maybe from the coast. And we just had the country to ourselves. It felt like it was great. It felt like a reward after we'd gone to war together. And so it was just, everyone was happy to be there and to be alive and all of that stuff. Right. And we knew we had it good. So it was pretty awesome.
Now, after this run in West Africa, you decided to get out, correct?
I did.
What was the impetus for that decision? I mean, you had sort of lusted after this for so long, and you finally got to where you wanted to go, and then it's time to move on?
Yeah, so my wife was in the CIA at the time. So she was a case officer, and she was posted to a different country in West Africa. And we had been married for, I don't know, 4 years or almost 5 years, and had never lived together. And so there was just kind of, you know, a lot of strain being put on that. And this was kind of the goal line, so to say. So it was like, you know, we kind of knew this was the plan for a while. And even though I knew it was the plan, I was really sad when I left the Army, when I drove off of Fort Carson. I turned in my sort of parking sticker, you know, took a razor blade to the sticker on the front of my car that lets me get on base and all that stuff, and turned it in and drove across the country and then caught a flight to go to West Africa with, you know, basically all my stuff in the back of my truck. And it was just kind of, it was not a happy day. And I guess I kind of knew that it wouldn't be a happy day, but you know, it's like, you can't do two things at the same time. And these are just the hard decisions that we have to make. And so, yeah, so I got out and moved to West Africa.
Yeah. That's not
a different part of West Africa.
I was going to say, but that's not a place a lot of people want to move. So why there? Was it to be with your wife at the time?
Yeah, so she was posted there. So, you know, their postings there are 3 years, 2 or 3 years or something. So, you know, she had a diplomatic house and all that jazz, right? And I was going to be, you know, her sidekick, her spouse. And that was, and I was super cool with that, you know? It was cool until it wasn't, though, just overall. Like, it turns out you need to kind of spend time together in order to, like, relationships don't work if you try to skip to the end 5 years later. So,
yeah. The relationships tend to be a pain in the ass like that. You kind of have to be in them for them to work out for everybody involved.
Yeah, even in a time of war, you know, God and country stuff, it's just kind of how it works.
So you're in West Africa. When does the idea for Go Ruck come about?
So the idea for Go Ruck was her idea. And Emily's idea. And, you know, I was still in the Special Forces mindset. I built a go bag or a go ruck for her. And I just put some stuff in it. I put it in her car. And I said, hey, you know, you're driving around because they love a good zoo in Africa. We know this, right? And so, hey, you've got some stuff in here. If anything happens, this is what's in here. And we went through it. Just drive around. You've got this now. And had another one for the house. You know, it's just in case something bad happens and here's where your stuff is. You know what you need to grab if you have to flee. And as I was looking for something to do in West Africa, it was kind of like, all right, well, you can do the Go Ruck thing for a year or whatever, and then we'll go back and live in D.C. and I'll be at Langley. And then Michael and I'd go to the farm and we'd be in the CIA together or whatever that might entail. We still had a lot to figure out. And we didn't really get to figure any of that stuff out, but that was the that was the plan at that time. So I was only there for 3 or 4 months, and then two or three months. Sorry, and then I was back home and was sort of going through the split, the separation, all that kind of stuff. So then I'm out of, you know, I've chosen, but I don't have a job. I don't have a life. I don't really know what I'm going to do with my life. I'm kind of starting over and don't have a lot in my corner at that point. And that's, you know, early 2009. And then through that year, pushing forward.
And any sort of regrets or second guessing, I shouldn't have got out, I should have stayed in. I mean, you know, or, you know, do you just realize that, hey, you know, the relationship is more important regardless?
I mean, when everything's going bad, everything is kind of up for grabs in your own mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I shouldn't have done this, I should have done that. You just sit and second guess everything. It's when you don't have any confidence because you've lost it because some external force happened. And most of the time we make our own bed. Sometimes really bad stuff just happens. But, you know, in our case, you know, we had chosen to do this, right? I mean, she chose to join the CIA. She chose to go deploy to serve our country, and she did so honorably. And I chose to join the military, and I chose to, you know, and I wouldn't trade anything like that. I guess my point is that there's no kind of, sometimes there's just casualties of the decisions we make, and it's not meant to be. It's just kind of, this is what happened. And, you know, I don't sit and say, oh, well, it had to fail or all these things, like it was so bad to begin with. I don't feel like that way at all. Right. It just kind of, if you take away these support structures, if you take away the things that make someone confident, if you take away the things that make relationships work, and you just keep taking and taking and taking, eventually everything breaks. I mean, you learn this in SEER school. You learn this, like, eventually everybody breaks, and relationships are no different, and people are no different. And so, you know, those people on high horses and those people that, you know, haven't had anything bad happen to them, but have a lot of opinions, right? I mean, that's kind of not that. Kind of not how the world goes, in my opinion, right? Like, at some point, everybody finds something really tough, and right, everybody finds something really bad, and then you got to sort of figure out how to deal with it. But if you sit and for your whole life feel like you're a victim of what, right? Like, oh, well, this shouldn't have happened, or I could have gone back and I could have done this and done that. Sure, like, you know, I could have bought the computer with the video camera so we could have seen each other more often, because it was an early technology back then. I was like,
yep. Yeah,
screw this, man. It's like too expensive. It's not going to work. And I'm like, we're not going to do that. And so we didn't do it. Like, there's always stuff like that, you know, and the internet was terrible and all this stuff. And maybe that wasn't the silver bullet that would have saved us, is my point. And so you can deconstruct the past, but ultimately, we all have to learn how to make peace with really terrible things. Things happen, and they're not great. And, you know, if we're still around, we have to make peace with them, and we have to move forward.
So which part of the Green Beret that you were comes out the most in these moments where, you know, you talk about, again, I don't know what I'm going to do, and I don't know where I'm going next. I mean, do you sort of innately fall back on that individual to figure out how to plan for what's next and what you do?
I mean, that was an interesting time. I've never really felt anything quite like that. And before I become a Green Beret, like, the thing is you... people think that leadership or confidence is something that you either have or you don't. It's kind of not true, right? Like, you're kind of gaining it by doing hard things, and by testing yourself and reinventing yourself and pushing forward and learning and adapting. It's not something that you just kind of oh, you know, you just sort of have it or you don't. It's not like riding a bike. There are levels of this. And so, you know, when life got really hard, I mean, the part of me, it was probably, you know, more the part of me that loved my dog and loved my family and loved my grandparents and stuff like that, that I leaned on more than the, or that was more effective than the part of me that's like, oh, I'll figure out a way to pick my rucksack up and do it myself. And, you know, I think every Green Beret knows how to do the, hey, I'll pick up my rucksack and do it myself. What's harder is when you have to, you can't do something yourself. And I kind of realized that. And it kind of took my dog. I was like, man, I just lived for that dog. And he lived for me. And it was one of those things where it was just this symbiotic relationship that we have. And it was great. And it's one of the strongest bonds that I've had in my life. And so, you know, that's what I needed at that time. And you know, it was very different than when you're in training and you got one hard thing after another and you have to just do it. I mean, that stuff at some point, it becomes kind of easy. And I don't say that lightly, right? You're in war and it's like, sure, this mission, that mission, this mission, that mission. You're just kind of doing it. It's the curveballs that are by definition curveballs. So, you know, I had to kind of rebuild some of the support structures around me, or how my viewpoint was on needing support structures. And that was the Green Beret in me, not so much. You know, the definition or the classic definition of Green Beret, not so much. Although, you know, team and all that stuff, right? You can never divorce that from me. It had to manifest a lot.
So how does the actual company, you know, get started from the idea of, you know, your wife at the time when you were in West Africa, how does those initial ideas blossom into what is next? And what are the sort of initial steps you take to start building GoRuck?
Yeah. So I, you know, got back to America. I needed something to do, a place to add I like the idea of GoRuck and kind of take the special forces way of life and apply it to other stuff. And so I placed an ad in, and I had some ideas on some backpacks or some rucksacks, and placed an ad in Craigslist, New York City for a backpack designer, and found one that was living out in Montana. And took a couple years, but then had some functional prototypes. And I'm in business school now by the time. So life's kind of, it's something. It's moving towards the right direction, right? Like I have GoRuck as a hobby. I have a dog that I just love to death. I have, you know, I'm in school. So there's kind of some schedule and some organization. And you know, I'm living in D.C. And things are kind of turning around slowly. These things don't happen overnight, right? If someone's selling you a quick fix, like run the other direction because it doesn't exist. You have to kind of build yourself back up slowly. And so that's what I was doing. And before too long, you know, I had some rucksacks in my condo and I thought everyone was going to want them. And I'm in business school, so I'm so smart, you know?
Well, in fairness, you did go to Georgetown Business School, so let's not undersell that part. I mean, you know, it's a pretty prestigious school.
Nobody wanted to buy them, and, you know, they're just rotting there. So eventually came up with an event called the GoRuck Challenge, which was, you know, based on a team building or team challenge led by a Green Beret, and you would wear your rucksack and do other types of physical training or PT throughout your event. And the first event was like 5 or 6 or 7 hours. And then they really blossomed from there.
I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up the role that the Green Beret Foundation played in some of this, correct? They were sort of essential in at least emotionally getting you the kick in the ass you needed at the time?
Yeah, so I made very early friends with some folks at the Green Beret Foundation. And, you know, it was just one of those things. I reached out to them and I said, hey, I was a Green Beret. I started this company. We're doing some cool stuff. And I just would like to be associated with and a part of the organization, however which way I can be. And, you know, so it was just one of those things where I just wanted to be still very much a part of the organization that I felt I owed so much to. And I wanted to figure out a way to give back. I didn't have anything to give back at that time, like in terms of money, but I had time and I could raise awareness and could talk about the Green Beret Foundation because I was leading a lot of events. And so I think it was, you know, it was very mutual. Because GBF was also a young organization. And when you're young in business or nonprofits or whatever, I mean, what you really need is awareness. And then, you know, the people that you're around, they'll kind of tell you if you're on the right path or not. Like, is this a noble cause? Is this something that we should support? Yes or no? Like, they will tell you. They will vote. And so it felt really good to just be a part of that. So we raised some money and we raised some awareness. And, you know, more than the money or even the awareness, I mean, it was selfish that I was doing it because I needed that part of my life to not die. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, I didn't want it to just go away into the oblivion forever. So it was really important to me, and the Green Beret Foundation is a really important organization that I'm proud to serve on now in a little bit different capacity.
You also are finishing, as we mentioned, business school at Georgetown. When you graduate, I mean, is it just the idea at this point in time is more GoRuck challenges because you're not tied down with school and everything else? Is that sort of the other part of the birthing process of this?
I was so ready to be out of school at that time. And I felt like Tyler Durden in Fight Club in business school. Because every weekend, man, I was just catching a flight to go to some city. And then I'd do a recon that would take me, you know, half a day. And then I'd lead the first event. And that was 12, 14 hours, right? And then I'd sleep in a park for 2 or 3 hours. And shove a giant sandwich down my throat or something. And I wake up and I'd lead another 12 or 14 hour event. And then I'd, you know, catch a bus for, you know, the subway to the airport or whatever. And then I'd drool on myself the whole way home. And then I'd go pick up my dog from, you know, my friend's house. And they would so graciously, Joe and Tony, if you're listening, I'll always love you. But they would just shove a bunch of food, homemade food down my throat. And Java was there, my dog. And it's like, all right, and tomorrow's Monday, right? And I'm just done. I mean, you know, you're looking at 50 miles on your feet and a few hours of sleep a night for the weekend. And then the work week begins. And that was my kind of experience, my second year of business school to a big extent. And so,
by the way, a lot of that sounds as sucky as, like, you know, the Q course and assessment and selection. You know, it doesn't sound like it's glorious work.
Yeah, but it was awesome, right? It's like telling, you know, some of the stories from the Q course, they were awesome. I mean, a lot of this, I mean, the actual ability to give back to people, we say building better Americans, and the ability to give back to Americans on the home front, some of the lessons that I'd learned in war, zero involved pulling triggers, right? This is about a mindset and a way of life. And this was about teaching people what they're made of and doing it in a way that they respond to, right? I'm not a drill sergeant. This isn't boot camp, right? But here's your rucksack and here's some sandbags. Pick them up. Like, let's go. This, you can do it, right? And it's really rewarding. And so that became kind of the drug. You know, I mean, before it was the team room and America's mission. And now I had to kind of adapt that and evolve it to being back at home. And I'm really grateful that I found St. some people that were willing to come and do this fun stuff with me.
So help me understand, when do you get out of the, or do you still do the Go Ruck challenges? If not, like, when do you transition from sort of that event-based model to an actual business where you just have inventory and you're selling products, so to speak?
Well, it's an interesting business model, and I say that because I haven't seen anything else like it, where organically we had an entire events company and an entire product company grow up, not only simultaneously, but symbiotically. And so, you know, we had the rucksacks that we worked on for years to finally build out and get built to scale and all that stuff. And the events became kind of the marketing, awareness driving action arm, and it was the energy in the room. And so, you know, it was messy. The finances were messy. The process was messy for a long time. And eventually what happened was the gear became more scalable. Just people vote with their wallets in their time, right? And it's kind of like, don't tell me what matters to you. Show me what your bank account and your calendar looks like, and I'll tell you what matters to you. And so people vote with actions. And so, you know, that said, we put on like 1,000 events in 2019, right before COVID. And COVID decreased us, but, you know, we put on 500 events last year, right? And so the point is that we put on a lot of events. It's very
right.
Core to our DNA, but the product is just infinitely more scalable.
So
and we've just been proving this, right? Like, we've been proving this since day one. Like, if you want the best rucksack on the planet, it's a Go Ruck, right? If you want it's the most proven, it's got the best guarantee, and if you put something in it, it feels the best. It's really simple. And we've proven that in the most stressful environments on planet Earth since 2010. And so that's the scalability of the gear side, and the event side is just our heart, you know? Like, you got to feed your heart too. And the people lie in the events. We don't just want to ship to you. We want to see you, and we want to do some work with you. So let's go outside and let's do some awesome stuff. And when we're done, let's drink some beers together and let's keep talking about the world.
So your stepdad had to invest money into the company just to get more rucks, correct?
Yeah, he's the only other investor in Go Ruck, and that came very early on because I had to buy inventory, and I'd spent everything I earned in the wars, right? sounds good. Everything I'd earned in the wars was spent. I was in business school at the time, so this was, you know, R&D costs and all that, and then I had to scale up. So yeah, so he invested, bought some inventory, and then got to work kind of figuring out how to sell them.
I mean, how much of a lift was that from a business standpoint? Like, do you survive without that investment?
Yeah, I'm a survivor, so yes. I mean,
well, does Go Ruck survive?
I could probably make the case that was the worst thing I could have done.
Really?
Except that he got involved. He got involved. So, you know, and he was a trusted advisor, and he's our COO now, by the way.
Okay.
So, you know, like, this is work. And he was on, you know, joined the quote board, and, you know, which was me and him talking about things over a case of beer. I guess there's this fascination. So look, I have no regrets. It's been and is an awesome journey with Mike, and I'm grateful for his mentorship and his advice. And I was very lucky to have him in my corner and have been for my entire life. The thing is that I feel like there's this, and I was certainly in the business school mindset, there's this kind of fascination and worship of going out and raising money and doing all that stuff. And that's, it's great. It's fine. Right. But there's another way to do it. It's just a little bit slower and it's a little bit more hustle. And so if I would not have taken money, what I would have done was I would have ordered less inventory out of the gates, which by the way, did not sell for a period of time, and would have not traveled around to 48 states. I would have instead stayed in my condo, and I probably would have figured out more stuff closer to home, and I would not have burned through as much cash, and I would not have had, you know, the other bedroom full of inventory, and I would not have had my buddy's attic full of inventory in DC. The point is that, you know, cash is like oxygen to a business, and you have to have it. And I say this as like a guy that I don't wake up thinking about money, and I don't go to bed thinking about money. But in the middle of the day, every once in a while, I've got to check in on everything that has a number that really matters, because if you let that stuff go astray, you're going to go out of business. And I feel like a lot of veterans might struggle with this, because you have to respect what it means to be in business. And if you're kind of want to just turn a blind eye to the numbers or to the money side, you're going to go out of business. Mm-hmm. Like that's just the thing. The Grim Reaper's coming for you. And you have to manage it. You have to manage it closely, not razor's edge all the time, but you have to manage it. And so if you take a bunch of money and you get saddled with a bunch of debt, I mean, that has consequences. And I've been fortunate on that front, but you know, there's other times we've taken small business loans and stuff to scale up other inventory. And, you know, eventually you have to pay this stuff back. Like that's how it works. You have to service your debt. There's interest rates. There's all of these things. And so, you know, everyone, it's a very sexy thing to go out and get money. It's not that sexy to pay it back. And people don't really write stories about, oh, man, it really sucked to pay it back. Right?
No, but listen, to your point, I will say this much. As somebody who has used his deployment money to pay off everything that he ever owes, I'm the most liquid person in the world. And it is a amazing feeling every night, other than the mortgage on my house, right? I don't owe anything to anybody. I don't have a car loan. I don't got student loans. There is no debt to my name anywhere, right? Because the house is equity and no one needs a business class. But to your point, it is such a relieving feeling to not owe anyone anything in this world, right? Like if you took away everything, I still don't owe anything.
And hey, I'll even push it a step further and say, like, I'm not the most risk averse person, right? Like I'm very comfortable. I'm comfortable betting on myself, and I'm comfortable with a high degree of calculated risk. And I will just tell you, like I've never lost. I won't say never. I've never in a sustained manner, I'm going to choose my words carefully, in a sustained manner, lost sleep over money, right? There's been a couple times where we got not a good space and had to make some decisions that were not fun, right? Those are short flashes in time, but I don't go to bed stressed out about this stuff. And you know, I guess I'm kind of built to endure through that, mm-hmm. right? Like I'm just going to keep driving on. Like that's just kind of part of the deal. And yet it's not that great to be saddled with debt. Like I say that to say objectively, it's just not that great. And I think that it's especially with COVID and the way that things have gone with shocks, the system and, you know, how the stock market's really high and Bitcoin's worth millions of bucks. And like, there's just some weird stuff going on. And my take in out of this is there's more room than ever for really solid brands, right? Brands that can endure shocks because they built passionate followings or they built communities or they built something like that. And I think that there's more emphasis on profitability. Like profitability is it's cool, right? Mm-hmm. It's profitability is cooler than going out and chasing other people's money. I know that that's sounds, however, it sounds like some capitalistic whatever, but guess what? This is a capitalistic system. And like, I believe in that system. I don't worship money, but you have to have businesses that make money. Like at some point, someone has to do the hard work. You have to build things and you have to sell things that provide value to people. That's kind of the deal. It can be a service. It can be a thing. But all this funny stuff going around all over the place, you know, at some point, someone wants their money back. And it's not a bad, sorry, that's not a good place to be on the end of a phone call.
Was there a moment for you that you can remember where GoRuck got to a point where you knew you didn't have to worry about money anymore? Like, do you remember that moment where you're like, you know what? We've got our head above the clouds. You know, we're above water. We're not going to fall back below. I have got the security from this company and the stability that I need. Like, was there a specific moment that happened for you?
Well, I never thought about it like that. It's never been a money thing for me. It's more been I didn't want the brand of GoRuck to die, or what GoRuck represented. And it took me a long time to figure out that you have to have a sustainable business for the brand to not die, right? Like, you can't just have a brand. It doesn't work, right? You know, you and your Instagram account being cool and stuff is not enough. I mean, you have to actually build a business. And the fundamentals of business are, you know, supply, demand, price, all that kind of stuff, right? And so there was never a moment where I'm like, oh, we've made it. Like to say that kind of makes me feel dirty, right? Because I think we just have so much more to give back in terms of, like, we want people to be active. We want communities to be stronger. We want people to be empowered, right? And that work is just never done. To me, it's just God's work. It's like, the mission of the Green Berets is never going to be over, you know? And so that it's fun to be a part of something like that, though, when it's never over and you wake up and you have mission and purpose and it feels really good. So, you know, I mean, like, frankly, there's still a huge part of me that wishes I had gone through the original plan, right? I'm in the ground branch or whatever at the agency, and I'm working out of an embassy and, you know, doing God's work for America somewhere else. You know, you don't get to live two lives though. And I very much am committed to GoRuck and to the mission that we have and to what we're able to do. And so I had to make peace with the fact that was my calling.
You wrote a book, and it's aptly titled How Not to Start a Backpack Company, but it's about a lot more than what, you know, the title would indicate. So kind of enlighten me to why you wrote the book and what it touches on. And it seems very personal in nature.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much stuff out there, and everyone wants to write a self-help book, and everyone wants to give you the three-step process, and everyone wants to tell you, you know, buy this and, you know, buy this and everything's going to be fine. And that's just not how the world works, that at least the life that I've led. And so I'm attracted to people's stories that are kind of real and honest. And this is what it was like for me. And I think that there's a lot that binds us together as humans that we gloss over too often in favor of the sort of veneer that people put up. Like, everything's great all the time. And I've got my stuff together and you need to get your stuff together too. And 1, 2, 3, bada bing, bada boom, buy this and it's going to be perfect. And so, you know, I kept a journal in the summer of 2010, and life was pretty not great. And I was driving around through all 48 states with my dog for most of it, and had a couple people with me, and trying to figure out how to build a business in America. And it was a colossal failure. But America was really beautiful, and I met a lot of really great people, and it certainly was an adventure, and it kind of let me escape whatever, well, the lot of things that I was trying to escape at that time. So in that regard, it was successful, and I didn't have to go work at a bank for some type of internship between my 2 years of business school, and I was grateful for that. And I just thought that, look, we didn't make a big deal about this book. It wasn't kind of a huge, you know, we self-published it and, you know, sold thousands of copies. We're not like doing huge book tours and everything. It's mostly just like, look, this is my story. This is how it was in the early days. And for those people who are at our company or those people who are in the community, sometimes you have to remember your roots. And the roots were, this whole thing was pretty precarious, right? It was not just preordained to succeed. Not like it's not like the universe just conspired and said, man, I just really need this. The world just needs a backpack company right now. You know, it's not how it worked at all. And so there's just some value, I think, in, because we talked about this earlier. A lot of people's paths are difficult. And portraying some of the difficulties as honestly as possible. And in this case, it's a private journal that I kept in the summer of 2010, right? It's personal. It's like, look, lots of people struggle in big ways, but you can get through this. And that's kind of where, that's where I am. You know, I went and was really proud to have served, but I want to only have been a Green Beret for the rest of my life. I have a lot more to give back, you know, and I don't want to only have started Go Ruck or only have just done one backpack. And like, there's always more to do. There's more. You got to kind of reinvent yourself as you move forward. And so, look, this was something that I worked together with one of the photographers, or the photographer who was with me that summer. And he took a lot of beautiful photos, and I took a lot of photos of my dogs. And we synced up in like January of this year. And then the pandemic happened, COVID. And so we just kind of worked on it remotely in the early days of the pandemic, and eventually released it. And, you know, the people that found it and read it, at a minimum, they're like, all right, this was real. You know, and that's what we were going for, right? Because, you know, one day my kids will read it, you know, the people that work at Go Ruck will read it, the community has read it, and it's kind of an honest look on what it feels like in the room when you're starting a company. Not the 1, 2, 3, 4, this is how to set up a bank account. If you need someone to tell you how to set up a bank account, don't go become an entrepreneur, right? But this is just more, this is how miserable it was for me. And this is what Murphy striking looks like. And so, you know, for you, it might be something else, but it's going to be kind of like this.
To that end, when I say Go Ruck, $100 million company, what's the first thing that pops in your mind?
I'm kind of cold to that. I write it and I talk about these numbers. Because if you don't, then people assume, they just don't know. And so they think that, you know, oh, it's 100 times bigger. It's a fraction of the size. Who knows? I just, you know, that stuff just doesn't motivate me. I want us to grow, and I want more people to live the special forces way of life, which is what we're based on. So, you know, the company needs to grow as well. And growth is certainly fun, but, you know, you could say a $1 billion company and I'll have the same reaction.
All right. So let me rephrase it then.
Like, cool, let's do it.
Let me rephrase it then. How does the company Go Ruck define success?
Yeah. So it's a striking balance between kind of the business goals, so to say, but it really comes down to the people, right? I mean, and when I say that, I mean, like We have 450 ruck clubs throughout the country, right? So community-led ruck clubs. They get together on the days, weeks, afternoons of their choosing, and they bring people together, and they work out. And then maybe they talk about their lives. Maybe they drink some beer. Maybe they go to dinner. I don't know. It's up to them, right? That's what the deal is. And when you start to say, how do we grow that? Because so much of the world is focused on living an experience online. And how many followers do you have here? And how many, quote, friends do you have? And look, those things are fine. Social media is a tool. Your phone is a tool. It's like a computer in your pocket. It's awesome, right? Use it wisely. It's like the end of Indiana Jones, you know? You have chosen poorly. You have chosen wisely, right? Choose wisely. Don't spend all of your days scrolling through someone else's feed. So when I think about what does success look like, there's not a huge measurement. I mean, I'm sure you have to attach some business metrics to it. But what I see is a world where, you know, rucking is a really big thing. And people are out doing it together in parks and on sidewalks and on trails. And, you know, they're meeting in their driveways and in their garages, and they're tossing sandbags around, and they're talking about their lives. And then they're going out for a walk, and they're talking to each other in the real world. And, you know, I see a world where rucking is bigger than jogging or running. And I can list you a million reasons why that should happen. We just have a lot of work to get there before it does. And so that's kind of the Northern Star for me, is strengthen the community, empower the individuals to lead more active lives and to strengthen the communities around them and build a business around that.
I mean, that's awesome. It's inspiring to hear you say it, and I'm not just blowing smoke. I got a smile on my face hearing you talk about it, because there really is there's a greater sense. I mean, I respect the business acumen, right? And I respect what it takes just to be able to build a $100 million company, because it's not easy. Because if it was, then everybody would have $100 million, and they don't. So from that standpoint, those metrics have value, but that doesn't mean that it has to define your worth, if that makes sense. And so when I hear you talk about the idea of rucking and go ruck and what it means and the community that it builds and everything else, you know, the value on that and the worth of that, I would assume in your mind exceeds any dollar value that the company is actually worth.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just not, it's at some point really deep inside of me, it's kind of, I will always owe, right? I'm still alive. I'm a better person because I went to war. I'm vertical, not horizontal. You know, the things that it's sort of like military humor. It's either slapstick or really dark, right? Really dark. Yeah. And so when you start, like, I don't want to drift too far in either direction, because I suck at slapstick, and the dark stuff is not usually the best place to go. But, like, look, I mean, you sort of smile when you say, look, I'm vertical, not horizontal. And it's like, you know, it could be so much worse. And I got buddies that aren't here anymore. And, you know, I've been through a lot, and I'm really just happy. And I'm happy to be able to give back, and I'm happy to be able to lead a life in America and to have a family. And you know, I'll keep giving until I got no more breath left in me. And so you take away some zeros, you add some zeros, it's cool. But there's a certain way of life and a commitment to excellence that I've kind of always had it inside of me, but the accountability that Special Forces provided me is something that remains a Northern Star, right? Like, I don't want to be the guy in the regiment that people are ashamed that I was in the regiment. And it's that same sort of fear of letting someone down or not meeting the standard in training or in war or whatever. And so you know, that's kind of the, it's a hugely motivating factor for me. And frankly, when you become blinded by or too motivated by money or the things that that entails, it's just, I mean, I think you trade too much of your life for it. And that said, like, look, I like to win and I want us to be really successful because I want to change a lot of lives. So there's always kind of forces that are at odds, and yet add a zero, take away a zero. My life's not going to change. I'm still going to be fighting for the causes and the fights that I believe in. And like, I know what enough looks like. I know what it feels like because I have enough. I have more than enough right now. And so I just want to keep on fighting a good fight.
Well, I encourage everybody to go to goruck.com and just search for events that are local in your area. There's plenty. They're easy to find. It's the website's very user-friendly from that standpoint. And take part in this whole thing because it really is the challenge is there, the mental, the physical challenge is there, and you talk about those rewards that you get on the other end from somebody who's done a little bit of rucking in this military career. There is a ton of reward in getting to the finish line of these things. So I recommend that you guys go do that. Any other sort of pieces of advice or you know, do you want them to go to goruck.com and look for stuff there? I mean, kind of tell people where they can get familiar with the products if they're not.
Yeah, so we just actually separated out all the events. The events are on from a technology platform. The events are at goruckevents.com and the merchandising stuff is at goruck.com, and we're on all the social channels. I mean, Instagram, Facebook, all that jazz. You know, I mean, look, my take is that we believe in personal responsibility and we want people to, you got to take the first steps somewhere. So if you're looking for somewhere, you want to be a part of something bigger than yourself. It doesn't have to be GoRuck. It doesn't have to be it doesn't have to be whatever you don't want it to be, but you need to join something, right? So go be more active, right? Get off your phone. Hopefully you're outside right now with a ruck on, staring up at blue skies, wherever you are. And, you know, you got good sweat kicking and you're like motivated and inspired. And that would be awesome. Right now, call a buddy up and say, hey, want to go do this thing. And that's the way of life that we promote. So, you know, that's what our community is about. And if you want to join us, then come get and fight.
Perfectly said, Jason. Again, I'm kind of in awe of all this, just learning more about the company and how you built it and your personal story. Again, the book is called How Not to Build a Backpack Company. If you guys want to pick it up and read it, and certainly continued success from a business standpoint, but your other goals, your other aspirations for what you're hoping to create in the GoRuck community, more success there, because you've certainly built something that we all can get behind. So again, thank you for being here, man. Thank you for sharing your story, and thank you for being part of the Hazard Ground.
Thanks, man. I appreciate your time.
You've been listening to the Hazard Ground Podcast, hosted by Mark Zeno. If you have an interesting story to tell and you'd like to be on the show, send us an email at producer@hazardground.com. And if you like the show, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.